You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of February 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, what does an outsider protest candidate do when people start taking him seriously? As economists take a long, hard look at whether Senator Bernie Sanders' sums really add up, does he need to descend to earth? And would his supporters forgive him if he did? My guests Kathleen Burke and Jonathan Fenby will discuss that and the day's other top stories, including Australia's wade into one of the world's most overused metaphors, i.e. the choppy diplomatic waters of the South China Sea, the closing stages of UK Prime Minister David Cameron's attempts to bring back an EU membership deal he can sell to the British people this summer, and the first glimmers of the new digital-only dawn of the independent. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the programme. My guests today are Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and Jonathan Fenby, former editor of the South China Morning Post, among many other journalistic postings, and now Managing Director of the China team at Trusted Sources. Welcome both. We will start tonight with the race for the White House, specifically with the race to be the Democratic nominee to occupy it from next January. The longer that Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders remains in the contest, the more necessary it is to consider the prospect of him winning, remote though the bookmakers and conventional wisdom may consider that prospect to be. As such, increasing scrutiny is falling on Sanders' actual policy promises, with specific regard to whether they are fiscally feasible. Kathleen, first of all, as reported in the New York Times this week, a bunch of actually quite left-leaning liberal economists have been taking the proverbial long, hard look at Mr. Sanders' sums. They surmise that his plans could swell the size of the federal government by 50% if he's lucky. How many Americans are likely to go out and vote for that, do we think?
What a question. If I knew that, I could win an awful lot of money on down at the bookies. It's a real problem because the people who are going to vote for him are probably going to vote for him no matter what he says because of the emotion involved, because his general message, stick with me and we'll turn this place upside down and everyone will be better off. Now, if you are a young, newly emerging young person or old person for that matter who hasn't paid a lot of attention to politics and all of a sudden you're swept up into it, you're not going to sit down and think, well, it may be an extra $12 trillion to do this medical, which is one of the sums. You're not going to think that. You're going to think, what a good thing if people can get fixed without bankrupting themselves. I mean, the problem is the situation now is so appalling that almost in terms of, in health terms, of what people can afford, even with the new Obamacare, which is granted has made things a lot easier for millions of people. Nevertheless, the whole situation is so awful that whatever Sanders says and says it confidently, obviously it's having an effect that those who are Sandarians, well,
Sanders Nistas, I believe, is the accepted vernacular. And Jonathan, to follow that up, will any of this critique, and I quote from former Obama advisor Austin Goolsbee, who said Sanders' plans were not merely puppies and rainbows, but the puppies have evolved into magic flying puppies with lotto tickets tied to their collars. Will that actually matter to his fans? Are we seeing the Democratic equivalent of the Trump phenomenon here, or you could even argue of the Corbyn phenomenon on this side of the Atlantic?
I don't think it matters to the core fans, as we just heard. I mean, they are true believers, and you get this in a lot of these political movements at the moment. Where it will matter is that if by some chance he had a really serious opportunity to get the Democratic nomination, or if he did actually get it, that means that he is a very, very minority candidate indeed, because I can't see, if you broaden this out into the mainstream, and then if you raise terrible questions, which of course is the Sanderistas would not even entertain at the moment, if he was actually elected, how would you get any of this through Congress at the moment? You know, the practicalities of it. We've seen this in a much less way, for instance, in France with Hollande, who François Hollande, who promised a lot of very good sounding stuff, tax the rich and give the money to the poor and so on and so on, and which became a complete cropper, as has happened again and again. And you get these movements, I think. It's so with UKIP in Britain. It's so with the National Front in France. It's so with Donald Trump, certainly, where it's a question of true belief and not of dollars and cents.
Kathleen, you mentioned there that one of Sanders' big ideas is the single-payer healthcare system, which would bring the US more or less into line with, let's see, literally every other country in the developed world. But even Governor Peter Shumlin in Vermont, Sanders' home state, couldn't get a single-payer system to happen there. Why is this so hard in America? Because as you quite correctly point out, the system or lack of system, even though Obama has improved, it is insane. It is bizarre and to anybody else from the developed world, completely inexplicable.
Well, first of all, remember, it's 50 state systems. It's not a federal system. So in many respects, so it cannot be imposed from Washington in the way that it can be imposed from London, shall we say, or Berlin. Secondly, the arguments against it are emotional ones in the sense that all these other countries which have these single-payer systems, have health systems, everyone knows, they say, that they're much worse, that if you want really good health care, you have to pay for it, and that's where you get it in America. I don't know. It's the fact that it didn't work in his own state doesn't seem to have made much of an impact. The fact that Hillary Clinton spent years when Bill Clinton was president trying to organize a revolutionary sort of health system to on the lines of a one that was more state dominated than it is now was a failure. And why Bernie Sanders thinks that he can do what even his own state governor who backed it couldn't do. Let's go for flying pigs. I like that.
Jonathan, if from a purely political point of view, if you are Bernie Sanders at this point and you are still a live candidate, possibly longer than you expected to be, Nevada caucuses coming up, which Sanders might win, South Carolina primary coming up, which he won't unless something extraordinarily bizarre has happened. But at this point, it's getting quite serious. What do you do? Do you try to trim your sails towards reality a little bit and risk being deserted by that fanatical core base, or do you just say full steam ahead, damn the torpedoes?
I think, and what he seems to be doing, is you try and reach out to other groups of electors who don't belong to, in this case, the Democratic Party establishment, and may be there for the courting, because you can offer them something, and so on. With all respect to the only socialist running in the United States for a very, very long time, I think you are peddling a kind of dream here. I mean, again, to go back to France, in 1981, François Mitterrand, when he was elected president, famously said, "What's wrong with dreaming?" And when you had an economy out of control and spiraling unemployment, which France is still living with a couple of years later, I think that's the problem. But dreams can carry campaigns along for quite a long time until you get to the moment where reality takes over. And I think a problem with the US process so far is that the nature, particularly of the Republican contest, has been such that this is still in an unreal world.
Well, that's roughly what I, in a sense, following on that line, is the Republicans are doing it. They're flying around in la-la land, and there's a whole other part of the electorate who will do it with the Democrats. The Republican, what's happening right now on the right-hand side of the spectrum, does not give convincing evidence that it won't happen on the left. Yeah. We may see this for months.
Well, that's on that happy prospect. let's look now at Australia, my homeland, a country blessed by colossal good fortune in many respects, not least by its distance from the world's trouble spots. This has not prevented it, however, from, and I'm having a good metaphor day, possibly a bad one, but from attempting to insert a block of its own into the precarious geostrategic Jenga game, which is the South China Sea. Australia's Foreign Minister Julie Bishop, ahead of a visit to Beijing, said that Australia recognise the right of the Philippines to seek arbitration in its dispute with China over the South China Sea. This has gone down predictably well in Beijing. Jonathan, you know China well. You speak, if not literally Chinese, then I guess the sense of Chinese diplomats speak. The statement from the Chinese Foreign Ministry I was particularly tickled by. We hope Australia can adopt an objective, fair and impartial position and not do anything to harm regional peace and stability. Now, is that any less sinister than it sounds?
No, I mean, China's, you know, there's this double language here the whole time with China, with the South China Sea.
That basically translates as shut up, doesn't
it? Yeah, shut up. It's we are peaceful, our peaceful expansion into these reefs and these islands, which we've been building the Great Wall of Sand across the South China Sea on the basis of a 1947 map, which nobody quite knows where it came from, which may be based on some claims going back to the Ming era, etc., etc. But we're doing this just to encourage peace and harmony in the South China Sea. And the only reason we're building these reefs is in case fishermen get into trouble so that we can rescue them.
Obviously.
The fact that we're building airstrips where you can land military jets, of course, has nothing, and carrying out military exercises has nothing to do with it. But what all this is that under Xi Jinping, who's the most powerful Chinese leader since Mao Zedong, in terms of hands-on control of policy, under him, China is pushing out. They're pushing out everywhere around the world. And obviously, first of all, in the immediate region, in the South China Sea, this is power projection of a very old-fashioned kind of way. And they don't want anyone to get in the way. And not to go into the details, which are pretty arcane, but this suit, which was referred to, was the Philippines taking China, a complaint against China, to a UN tribunal in The Hague. China says this is interference with its domestic affairs. It won't turn up at the hearings. It won't recognize the hearings. It says the UN has nothing to do with this. The UN tribunal at the end of last year ruled that it could deal with this, and we're expecting the judgment in the late spring. And that will be a really big test of whether China is going to live by internationally set rules or do its own thing. And obviously what Australia is particularly worried about, apart from the iron ore exports, which no longer take place as they used to China and are hitting the Aussie dollar, etc., etc., what they're really worried about is freedom of navigation in the South China Sea, which carries about $5 trillion US dollars worth of trade every year, rich fishing grounds, probably big energy, all the oil going into East Asia and the products coming out. This is an absolutely vital waterway, and that's really what it's about.
I'm a big fan of Chinese diplomatic language, and there have been some corkers associated with this story. China's foreign ministry also said it believes that Australia understands its position, understands China's position. I'm sure they do. Kathleen, Julie Bishop, Australia's foreign minister, though, has been indulging in a bit of diplo-speak of her own. She says, and Jonathan mentioned the artificial islands that China is building. Julie Bishop says that when in Beijing, she will be seeking clarification about what China is doing with those reclaimed islands. Is anyone, do we really think, in that much doubt?
Of course not. But what is she going to do if she's in Beijing? She can't say, I'm going to tell the Chinese that they'd better get the hell out of those islands or things will happen. I'll take steps. She has to say, can you tell me precisely what you think you're doing? I'd be very interested for some precision in what you intend to do. And especially since China did say that what the Philippines were doing was against international law. Yeah. I think the concept of international law is a bit wavy in China, and it's going to be difficult for any other country to appeal to it.
Well, if you speak of language, there was one great statement by a former Chinese foreign minister last year, I think it was. The fact is, they're just some big countries and some small countries, and they better get used to it.
To follow that up, though, Jonathan, how, in that divide between big countries and small countries, how would China look at Australia? Obviously, Australia is a big country geographically. It has a total population smaller than some Chinese cities. In recent years, one of our many prime ministers has been a fairly ardent Sinophile, of course, Kevin Rudd, who'd yep. worked there and spoke the language. I interviewed him for Monocle magazine several years ago while I think he was foreign minister. I lose track. But he always said that the thing with dealing with China and the Chinese was that they respect strength, that you don't go in and yell at them and tell them what to do, because obviously that plays pretty badly, but you don't do the kowtowing thing either. Even if Australia hits the right tone, does ultimately China actually care what Australia thinks about anything?
Not, frankly, not for China itself. But what China is worried about is what you might say late 40s containment in the European sense translated, that you have Japan, you have Australia, you have South Korea, you have the Philippines, all of which are linked with the United States, which is the biggest military power in the region, with the Seventh Fleet, which is the most powerful military instrument in the region. And I'd understand it if you're sitting in Beijing and looking at the map, you've got the chain of islands 100 miles off the Chinese coast, held by these countries which are allied with your big competitor for global influence, the United States. And of course, and you can't get your Blue Water Navy out because a lot of the channels go between islands where the Japanese particularly have military installations, and the US can have access to that very soon. And that's what China doesn't want, a combination of powers, including Australia, to gang up on it, in a sense. The trouble is, everything it's doing makes it more likely that that coalition will take place.
Yes, I mean, from the late 40s, that's an important point, because that's the ANZUS Treaty, Australia, New Zealand, and the U.S. And the U.S. pledges that it will come to the defense of Australia. It pledges it will come to the defense of Japan. It pledges it will come to the defense of Korea. So the problem with challenging Australia too much is that if you have the next American president, who perhaps is a bit more interested in foreign affairs in a lively sense than the current president, that it may actually wake up the United States again, that this pivot towards the Pacific is going to be more than trade, and therefore China has to be careful.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Kathleen Burke and Jonathan Fenby. Coming up next, are David Cameron's efforts to talk the EU into keeping the UK likely to lead to the UK leaving the EU?
How much information can you pack into a minute? Every morning, the Monocle Minute wings its way into your inbox, packed with the very latest news and views from around the world, all delivered with a monocle twist. We'll tell you what that new aircraft carrier means for Southeast Asia, why the next EU summit will be more interesting than normal, and what to look out for at an upcoming election. We'll pick out the latest retail trend in Latin America, analyse the aviation news in Australia, and take a tour of a neighbourhood that's on the up. And there's more. At the weekend, we'll review the best new restaurants, give you the lowdown on that art exhibition you've been meaning to visit, and dissect the best of the latest fashion week. See? There's rather a lot you can pack into a minute. Sign up now at monocle.com/minute.
You're welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Kathleen Burke and Jonathan Fenby. Now, EU leaders will meet later this week in Brussels, in part to consider the bargain that UK Prime Minister David Cameron will be permitted to put to the British people prior to a referendum on ongoing EU membership due this year, likely as soon as June 23rd. European Council President Donald Tusk, possibly affecting a measure of theatrical hardball, has suggested that the see if we care sentiment among EU states is hardening. But would the EU really be willing to let the UK go? Kathleen, how big a problem is going to be everybody else wanting anything that the UK might be offered?
Well, you mean piggybacking?
Yeah.
I mean, they're worried about...
Don't shout, sir, everybody will want one. Yeah.
Well, indeed. I mean, for example, the Catalonian president who has suggested that perhaps if Britain gets this, it might give him some flexibility in leaving Spain. Or the odd Greek who has proposed that if Britain gets this, they should have... there ought to be a lighter hand on them for finance, and they ought to get more help on migrants. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a real issue. I think they will be cowed down by the big countries. I think Germany won't let these little people interfere entirely with what they think is necessary. But I think I was more. The point is, when you have negotiations, A, everyone has to claim lots to start with, but B, if it's going to last, both sides have to feel they've gained something. So the question now is, where is the line between gaining and losing? And that is such a delicate one in this, because 28 different countries, most of them having different questions, it's going to be absolutely fascinating. But I think in the end, they'll be scared, and they don't want to lose Britain. The question is, of course, does Britain want to lose Europe?
Well, on that question, Jonathan, and this is my own pet theory, so apologies for interjecting that into the conversation, but does it actually matter what David Cameron comes back with? Because basically, the referendum, if it takes place this summer, will be a referendum on, it will be a referendum rather on immigration, won't it?
Yes, I mean, referendums are almost always on something other than they're actually supposed to be about. And they depend often, you know, we've seen this particularly in France, to go back there, with including the European referendum there, depending on how people feel, how the economy is doing, and so on. So I think a lot depends upon that. But it'll certainly the Brexit people will try to make it about immigration. Whether they will be able to make a broader case that appeals to people outside those already convinced. We're back, in a sense, here to the Bernie Sanders area. There are people who are fanatically for Brexit, come what may. There are people like myself who, you know, think it would be a disaster if we left Europe for lots and lots of reasons. And I'll say that more or less whatever comes out of the negotiations, so you can count for one vote. But there are a lot of people in the middle. And how many there are, how much that happens, I don't know. How much that's going to move, I don't know. And in a sense, it's probably in David Cameron's interest for it to be as boring as possible. And I think he's succeeding quite largely in that, because the more you have people who think, oh, well, it's not worth the trouble of taking the risk of leaving Europe.
Inertia is a wonderful thing, isn't it?
So, yeah. No, it's you know, apathy and a high abstention rate, and you get it through with 35. Of course, then you have the Brexit people jumping up and down and saying, you know, this wasn't a majority for it, and so on. But I think also there are all kinds of issues, some of which were just mentioned there. Which
people could then well argue that there wasn't a majority for this government either.
Exactly. So, yes.
Kathleen, one of the things that strikes me as a bit bewildering about this whole thing is that one of the key things David Cameron wants is to cut welfare benefits in the UK for Eastern European immigrants. Now, as someone myself who arrived in this country on extremely strict visa conditions, among which was an extremely stringent restriction on my ability to claim state benefits, which I thought was absolutely entirely fair enough because Britain does not owe me a living, why is that even controversial?
Well, it's not so controversial here, is it?
No.
It's controversial over there, where they've benefited. There are a million Poles in this country. All the ones I know, and everyone says this, and I fully agree, are very hardworking, and are not on benefits. And in general, the immigrants are net contributors to the British economy, not net deficit, as it were. But the thing is, I suspect that the Visegrad, so-called Visegrad, you know, Hungary and Czechoslovakia and Poland and Czech Republic and Slovakia, are concerned about the money, but I think they're also concerned about being referred to as second-class citizens of Europe. I mean, Hungarian Prime Minister Orbán says Hungarians are not parasites in England. So I think it's partly the money, but it's also partly because they're being referred to as less good Europeans, in a way, less full members of Europe than others.
Just a final thought on this, Jonathan. You mentioned there David Cameron's, I'm sure, ardent desire to keep this whole thing as boring as he possibly can. And you can only wish him luck with that. Because collective responsibility of the cabinet is going to be lifted, possibly as soon as Friday. Ministers can campaign according to their conscience. Could we end up with a sort of internecine bloodbath in the Conservative Party akin to what we are currently witnessing on the opposition benches?
Well, that's what David Cameron's been trying to avoid ever since he became party leader. If you remember, one of his first things on becoming party leader was to pull the Conservative group in the European Parliament out of the kind of moderate centre-right group and put it into a higgle-piggle with in all kinds of rather strange European right-wing parties, to say the least, at the time. And it's always, I mean, it's the case going back to John Major. Conservative leaders have always run scared of the Eurosceptics in their own ranks, and I think far too much so, just like they run scared far too much of The Sun and the Daily Mail and other newspapers and so on. Politicians, you know, don't always seem to have the resolve or the steel in their backbone, I think is the phrase that's used, that one might expect of them.
Well, finally tonight, and following last week's obituaries for the print editions of The Independent and The Independent on Sunday, plans for the newspaper's digital-only future are beginning to emerge. The new website Gillett, we're told, will have a staff of 75, among them the paper's renowned veteran foreign correspondents Robert Fisk and Patrick Coburn. They also promised to double the size of the New York office and appoint correspondents to Hong Kong, Beirut and Paris. Reports do suggest, however, that roughly 100 redundancies are looming. Kathleen, first of all, does this strike you as full steam ahead or rearranging the deck chairs?
Well, can I start with by giving I've been a reader of The Independent since the first day, the first issue, and I continue to receive it at home. So I think the paper is extremely good because it had a position, a liberal position, without being party political, and a moderate and a thoughtful position. And I'm afraid, and I'm sorry about that. The idea that everyone reads online, I suppose you do if you're under the age of 50. A lot of us don't, in fact, and I quite like having the paper in my hands. The rearranging the deck chairs, well, if The Independent does get the sort of investment it hasn't had in 20 or 30 years, well, not 30 years, but the last 15 or 20 years, it can only be a good thing, because the difficulty is that, as the editor said, the core writing membership of The Independent on Sunday was 12. Now, there's a distinct limitation to what you can actually do. You depend on stringers, I suppose. You depend on the wire services. And if The Independent no longer has to do this in quite such an extent as it did, that must be a good thing.
Jonathan, Kathleen was a reader of The Independent from day one. You were an editor of The Independent on day one. How do you feel about seeing it disappear from newsstands?
I think it was probably just about inevitable in the long term. It's partly a matter of investment. It's partly a matter of the market. It's partly a matter of some questionable business decisions made 20 years ago for The Independent, which made it dependent on financing for a series of owners who put money into it, who kept it alive and so on. I think there's potentially quite a snare and delusion in this, having been involved in various online ventures. In fact, when I was editing the South China Morning Post in Hong Kong, I think we were the first paper to put the newspaper fully online before the handover in 97 and so on. And you think, oh, it's simple, you know, we've got all this stuff, we just put it online, it goes there. But actually, it takes a lot of people, it's not as efficient as it appears, it takes time, and it has to be, to use the phrase, curated very carefully indeed, because everything is changing the whole time.
And as The Independent's current website demonstrates, it's incredibly easy to do it really badly.
Yes, yes, yes. And you've got to keep it up to date. You've got to produce, and no newspaper has produced a new online format and approach. And they've never really known their readers online. And if you just look at The Guardian and the huge losses which it's racked up online, you see just what a swamp this can become. So it may actually require more investment to produce a good product online than it did to produce it in print. Of course, you save money with the printing, etc., etc. But you need a complete rethink of this, not just put The Independent online, but let's produce a new kind of medium using a new product using this very, very different medium. You don't simply put a newspaper online. That doesn't work. You've got to evolve something new.
Final brief thought from you on this, Kathleen. Do you think especially a news outlet lacks gravitas if it doesn't have a print edition?
Well, we'll find out, won't we?
Yes.
I hope not. I mean, if the FT goes, I'll just have to kill myself.
Well, a drastic threat. And Jonathan, finally from you on this, as somebody who worked for The Independent and for many other newspapers, and in that sort of overlap between print and digital, could The Independent have thought of, this was just a thought that occurred to me, could they have thought of doing a weekly news journal akin to The Guardian's International Weekly, which is excellent, and that would give them still a print presence, a presence on the world's newsstands?
They could have thought of that. I don't know what the economics would be of that. I mean, the irony of this, not to go down memory lane too much, but in 86, when The Independent was launched, it was because there was a huge vacuum at the middle of British daily serious media. Exactly the same vacuum exists today for exactly the same reasons and with exactly the same players. But I don't really see anybody coming along with the bright idea that Andreas Whittam Smith had and knew how to put into practice in 86.
We will have to leave it there. Kathleen Burke, Jonathan Fenby, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all for today's episode of Midori House. It was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Yasmin Omar. Our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. Monocle's international playlist continues next. At 1900 hours, you can hear our design show, Section D, and we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time, or of course, any time you like after that on our website. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.